Chapter 5. Opportunity. One thing about being a U.S. Senator, you fly a lot. There are the flights back and forth from Washington at least once a week. There are the trips to other states to deliver a speech, raise money, or campaign for your colleagues. If you represent a big state like Illinois, there are flights upstate or downstate to attend town meetings or ribbon cuttings and to make sure that the folks don't think you've forgotten them. Most of the time, I fly commercial and sit in coach, hoping for an aisle or window seat, and crossing my fingers that the guy in front of me doesn't want to recline. But there are times when, because I'm making multiple stops on a West Coast swing, say, or need to get to another city after the last commercial flight has left, I fly on a private jet. I hadn't been aware of this option at first, assuming the cost would be prohibitive. But during the campaign, my staff explained that under Senate rules, a senator or candidate could travel on someone else's jet and just pay the equivalent of a first-class airfare. After looking at my campaign schedule and thinking about all the time I would save, I decided to give private jets a try. It turns out that the flying experience is a good deal different on a private jet. Private jets depart from privately owned and managed terminals, with lounges that feature big soft couches and big-screen TVs and old aviation photographs on the walls. The restrooms are generally empty and spotless, and have those mechanical shoeshine machines and mouthwash and mints in a bowl. There's no sense of hurriedness at these terminals. The plane is waiting for you if you're late, ready for you if you're early. A lot of times you can bypass the lounge altogether and drive your car straight onto the tarmac. Otherwise, the pilots will greet you in the terminal, take your bags, and walk you out to the plane. And the planes, well, they're nice. The first time I took such a flight, I was on a Citation 10, a sleek, compact, shiny machine with wood paneling and leather seats that you could pull together to make a bed anytime you decided you wanted a nap. A shrimp salad and cheese plate occupied the seat behind me. Up front, the minibar was fully stocked. The pilots hung up my coat, offered me my choice of newspapers, and asked me if I was comfortable. I was. Then the plane took off, its Rolls-Royce engines gripping the air the way a well-made sports car grips the road. Shooting through the clouds, I turned on the small TV monitor in front of my seat. A map of the United States appeared, with the image of our plane tracking west, along with our speed, our altitude, our time to destination, and the temperature outside. At 40,000 feet, the plane leveled off, and I looked down at the curving horizon and the scattered clouds, the geography of the Earth laid out before me. First the flat checkerboard fields of western Illinois, then the Python curves of the Mississippi, then more farmland and ranchland, and eventually the jagged Rockies, still snow-peaked, until the sun went down and the orange sky narrowed to a thin red line that was finally consumed by night and stars and moon. I could see how people might get used to this. I took a trip that made me think about what was happening with the economy. This one was by car, not jet, along miles of empty highway, to a town called Galesburg, 45 minutes or so from the Iowa border in western Illinois. I'd gone to meet with a group of union leaders from the Maytag plant, for the company had announced plans to lay off 1,600 employees and shift operations to Mexico. Like towns all across central and western Illinois, Galesburg had been pounded by the shift of manufacturing overseas. In the previous few years, the town had lost industrial parts makers and a rubber hose manufacturer. It was now in the process of seeing Butler Manufacturing, a steelmaker recently bought by Australians, shutter its doors. Already, Galesburg's unemployment rate hovered near 8%. With the Maytag plants closing, the town stood to lose another 5 to 10% of its entire employment base. Inside the machinists' union hall, 7 or 8 men and 2 or 3 women had gathered on metal folding chairs, talking in muted voices, a few smoking cigarettes, most of them in their late 40s or early 50s, all of them dressed in jeans or khakis, t-shirts, or plaid work shirts. The union president, Dave Bavard, explained that the union had tried every possible tactic to get Maytag to change its mind, talking to the press, contacting shareholders, soliciting support from local and state officials. The Maytag management had been unmoved. "It ain't like these guys aren't making a profit," Dave told me. "And if you ask them, they'll tell you we're one of the most productive plants in the company. Quality workmanship, low error rates. We've taken cuts in pay, cuts in benefits, layoffs. The state and the city have given Maytag at least $10 million in tax breaks over the last 8 years, based on their promise to stay. But it's never enough. Some CEO who's already making millions of dollars decides he needs to boost the company's stock price so he can cash in on his options. And the easiest way to do this is to send the work to Mexico and pay the workers there a sixth of what we make. I asked them what steps state or federal agencies had taken to retrain workers. And almost in unison, the room laughed derisively. Retraining's a joke, the union vice president, Doug Dennison, said. What are you going to retrain for if there aren't any jobs out there? One of the younger men in the group told me a particularly cruel story. He had made up his mind to retrain as a computer technician, but a week into his courses, Maytag called him back. The Maytag work was temporary, but according to the rules, if this man refused to accept Maytag's offer, he'd no longer be eligible for retraining money. If, on the other hand, he did go back to Maytag and dropped out of the courses he was already taking, then the federal agency would consider him to have used up his one-time training opportunity and wouldn't pay him for any retraining in the future. I told the group that I'd tell their story during the campaign and offered a few proposals that my staff had developed. Amending the tax code to eliminate tax breaks for companies who shifted operations offshore, revamping and better funding federal retraining programs. As I was getting ready to go, a big sturdy man in a baseball cap spoke up. He said his name was Tim Wheeler, and he'd been the head of the union at the nearby Butler steel plant. Workers had already received their pink slips there, and Tim was collecting unemployment insurance, trying to figure out what to do next. His biggest worry now was health care coverage. My son Mark needs a liver transplant, he said grimly. We're on the waiting list for a donor, but with my health care benefits used up, we're trying to figure out if Medicaid will cover the costs. Nobody can give me a clear answer. And you know, I'll sell everything I got for Mark and go into debt. But I still... Tim's voice cracked. His wife, sitting beside him, buried her head in her hands. I tried to assure them that we would find out exactly what Medicaid would cover. Tim nodded, putting his arm around his wife's shoulder. On the drive back to Chicago, I tried to imagine Tim's desperation. No job, an ailing son, his savings running out. Those were the stories you missed on a private jet at 40,000 feet. You'll get little argument these days from either the left or the right with the notion that we're going through a fundamental economic transformation. Advances in digital technology, fiber optics, the internet, satellites and transportation have effectively leveled the economic barriers between countries and continents. Pools of capital scour the earth in search of the best returns, with trillions of dollars moving across borders with only a few keystrokes. The collapse of the Soviet Union, the institution of market-based reforms in India and China, the lowering of trade barriers, and the advent of big-box retailers like Walmart have brought several billion people into direct competition with American companies and American workers. There's no doubt that globalization has brought significant benefits to American consumers. But there's also no denying that globalization has greatly increased economic instability for millions of ordinary Americans. To stay competitive and keep investors happy in the global marketplace, U.S.-based companies have automated, downsized, outsourced, and offshored. They've held the line on wage increases and replaced defined benefit health and retirement plans with 401ks and health savings accounts that shift more cost and risk onto workers. The result has been the emergence of what some call a winner-take-all economy, in which a rising tide doesn't necessarily lift all boats. Over the past decade, we've seen strong economic growth and anemic job growth, big leaps in productivity, but flatlining wages, hefty corporate profits, but a shrinking share of those profits going to workers. For those with unique skills and talents, and for the knowledge workers, the engineers, lawyers, consultants, and marketers who facilitate their work, the potential rewards of a global marketplace have never been greater. But for those like the workers at Maytag, whose skills can be automated or digitized or shifted to countries with cheaper wages, the effects can be dire. A future in the ever-growing pool of low-paid service work, with few benefits, the risk of financial ruin in the event of an illness, and the inability to save for either retirement or a child's college education. The question is, what should we do about this? Since the early 90s, when these trends first began to appear, one wing of the Democratic Party, led by Bill Clinton, has embraced the new economy, promoting free trade, fiscal discipline, and reforms in education and training that will help workers to compete for the high-value, high-wage jobs of the future. But a sizable chunk of the Democratic base, particularly blue-collar union workers like Dave Bavard, has resisted this agenda. As far as they're concerned, free trade has served the interests of Wall Street, but has done little to stop the hemorrhaging of good-paying American jobs. For the most part, the Republican economic agenda under President Bush has been devoted to tax cuts, reduced regulation, the privatization of government services, and more tax cuts. Administration officials call this the ownership society, but most of its central tenets have been staples of laissez-faire economics since at least the 1930s. A belief that a sharp reduction, or in some cases elimination, of taxes on income, large estates, capital gains, and dividends will encourage capital formation, higher savings rates, more business investment, and greater economic growth. A belief that government regulation inhibits and distorts the efficient working of the market. And a belief that government entitlement programs are inherently inefficient, breed dependency, and reduce individual responsibility, initiative, and choice. So far, the Bush administration has only achieved one half of its equation. Congress has pushed through successive rounds of tax cuts, but Democratic lawmakers and the public have resisted cuts in vital investments and outright rejected the administration's proposal to privatize Social Security. Whether the administration actually believes that the resulting federal budget deficits and ballooning national debt don't matter is unclear. What is clear is that the sea of red ink has made it more difficult for future administrations to initiate any new investment to address the economic challenges of globalization or to strengthen America's social safety net. Over the long term, a strategy of doing nothing and letting globalization run its course probably means an America very different than most of us grew up in. It will mean an America even more stratified economically and socially than it currently is. One in which an increasingly prosperous knowledge class, living in exclusive enclaves, will be able to purchase whatever they want on the marketplace. Private schools, private healthcare, private security, and private jets, while a growing majority of their fellow citizens are consigned to low-paying service jobs, vulnerable to dislocation, working longer hours, dependent on an underfunded, overburdened, and underperforming public sector for their healthcare, their retirement, and their children's educations. It will mean an America in which we continue to mortgage our assets to foreign lenders and expose ourselves to the whims of oil producers. An America in which we underinvest in the basic scientific research and workforce training that will determine our long-term economic prospects and neglect potential environmental crisis. It will mean an America that's more politically polarized and more politically unstable as economic frustration boils over and leads people to turn on each other. Worst of all, it will mean fewer opportunities for younger Americans, a decline in the upward mobility that's been at the heart of this country's promise since its founding. That's not the America we want for ourselves or our children. We have the talent and the resources to create a better future, a future in which the economy grows and prosperity is shared. What's preventing us from shaping that future isn't the absence of good ideas. It's the absence of a national commitment to take the tough steps necessary to make America more competitive, and the absence of a new consensus around the appropriate role of government in the marketplace. To build that consensus, we need to take a look at how our market system has evolved over time. Calvin Coolidge once said that the chief business of the American people is business. And indeed, it would be hard to find a country on earth that's been more consistently hospitable to the logic of the marketplace. Our Constitution places the ownership of private property at the very heart of our system of liberty. Our religious traditions celebrate the value of hard work and express the conviction that a virtuous life will result in material reward. Rather than vilify the rich, we hold them up as role models, and our mythology is steeped with the stories of men on the make. The immigrant who comes to this country with nothing and strikes it big, the young man who heads west in search of his fortune. As Ted Turner famously said, in America, money is how we keep score. The result of this business culture has been a prosperity that's unmatched in human history. It takes a trip overseas to fully appreciate just how good Americans have it. Even our poor take for granted goods and services: electricity, clean water, indoor plumbing, telephones, televisions, and household appliances that are still unattainable for most of the world. It's useful to remind ourselves that our free market system is neither the result of natural law nor divine providence. Rather, it emerged through a painful process of trial and error, a series of difficult choices between efficiency and fairness, stability and change. And although the benefits of our free market system have mostly derived from the individual efforts of generations of men and women pursuing their own vision of happiness, in each and every period of great economic upheaval and transition, we've depended on government action to open up opportunity, encourage competition, and make the market work better. In broad outline, government action has taken three forms. First, government has been called upon throughout our history to build the infrastructure and train the workforce necessary for economic growth. All the founding fathers recognized the connection between private property and liberty, but it was Alexander Hamilton who also recognized the vast potential of a national economy, one based not on America's agrarian past, but on a commercial and industrial future. To realize this potential, Hamilton argued, America needed a strong and active national government. And as America's first Treasury Secretary, he set about putting his ideas to work. He nationalized the Revolutionary War debt, which not only stitched together the economies of the individual states, but helped spur a national system of credit and fluid capital markets. He promoted policies, from strong patent laws to high tariffs, to encourage American manufacturing, and proposed investment in roads and bridges needed to move products to market. Hamilton encountered fierce resistance from Thomas Jefferson, who feared that a strong national government tied to wealthy commercial interests would undermine his vision of an egalitarian democracy tied to the land. But Hamilton understood that only through the liberation of capital from local landed interests could America tap into its most powerful resource, namely, the energy and enterprise of the American people. This idea of social mobility constituted one of the great early bargains of American capitalism. Industrial and commercial capitalism might lead to greater instability, but it would be a dynamic system in which anyone with enough energy and talent could rise to the top. And on this point, at least, Jefferson agreed. It was based on his belief in a meritocracy, rather than a hereditary aristocracy, that Jefferson would champion the creation of a national, government-financed university that could educate and train talent across the new nation, and why he considered the founding of the University of Virginia to be one of his greatest achievements. This tradition of government investment in America's physical infrastructure and in its people was thoroughly embraced by Abraham Lincoln and the early Republican Party. For Lincoln, the essence of America was opportunity, the ability of free labor to advance in life. Lincoln considered capitalism the best means of creating such opportunity, but he also saw how the transition from an agricultural to an industrial society was disrupting lives and destroying communities. Hamilton and Lincoln's basic insight that the resources and power of the national government can facilitate, rather than supplant, a vibrant free market has continued to be one of the cornerstones of both Republican and Democratic policies at every stage of America's development. The Hoover Dam, the Tennessee Valley Authority, the Interstate Highway System, the Internet, the Human Genome Project. Time and again, government investment has helped pave the way for an explosion of private economic activity. And through the creation of a system of public schools and institutions of higher education, as well as programs like the GI Bill that made a college education available to millions, government has helped provide individuals the tools to adapt and innovate in a climate of constant technological change. Aside from making needed investments that private enterprise can't or won't make on its own, an active national government has also been indispensable in dealing with market failures, those recurring snags in any capitalist system that either inhibit the efficient workings of the market or result in harm to the public. It was during the crash of 1929 and the subsequent depression that the government's vital role in regulating the marketplace became fully apparent. With investor confidence shattered, bank runs threatening the collapse of the financial system, and a downward spiral in consumer demand and business investment, FDR engineered a series of government interventions that arrested further economic contraction. The New Deal administration experimented with policies to restart the economy, and although not all of these interventions produced their intended results, they did leave behind a regulatory structure that helped limit the risk of economic crisis. A Securities and Exchange Commission to ensure transparency in the financial markets and protect smaller investors from fraud and insider manipulation. FDIC insurance to provide confidence to bank depositors. And countercyclical fiscal and monetary policies, whether in the form of increased liquidity or direct government spending, to stimulate demand when business and consumers have pulled back from the market. Finally, and most controversially, government has helped structure the social compact between business and the American worker. During America's first 150 years, as capital became more concentrated in trusts and limited liability corporations, workers were prevented by law and by violence from forming unions that would increase their own leverage. Workers had almost no protection from unsafe or inhumane working conditions, whether in sweatshops or meatpacking plants. Nor did American culture have much sympathy for workers left impoverished by capitalism's periodic gales of creative destruction. The recipe for individual success was greater toil, not pampering from the state. What safety net did exist came from the uneven and meager resources of private charity. Again, it took the shock of the Great Depression, with a third of all people finding themselves out of work, ill-housed, ill-clothed, and ill-fed, for government to correct this imbalance. 2 years into office, FDR was able to push through Congress the Social Security Act of 1935, the centerpiece of the new welfare state, a safety net that would lift almost half of senior citizens out of poverty, provide unemployment insurance for those who had lost their jobs, and provide modest welfare payments to the disabled and the elderly poor. FDR also initiated laws that fundamentally changed the relationship between capital and labor. The 40-hour work week, child labor laws, and minimum wage laws, and the National Labor Relations Act, which made it possible to organize broad-based industrial unions and forced employers to bargain in good faith. Part of FDR's rationale in passing these laws came straight out of Keynesian economics. One cure for economic depression was putting more disposable income in the pockets of American workers. But FDR also understood that capitalism in a democracy required the consent of the people, and that by giving workers a larger share of the economic pie, his reforms would undercut the potential appeal of government-managed command-and-control systems, whether fascist, socialist, or communist, that were gaining support all across Europe. For a while, this seemed to be where the story would end, with FDR saving capitalism from itself through an activist federal government that invests in its people and infrastructure, regulates the marketplace, and protects labor from chronic deprivation. And in fact, for the next 25 years, through Republican and Democratic administrations, this model of the American welfare state enjoyed a broad consensus. There were those on the right who complained of creeping socialism, and those on the left who believed FDR had not gone far enough. But the enormous growth of America's mass production economy, and the enormous gap in productive capacity between the U.S. and the war-torn economies of Europe and Asia, muted most ideological battles. Without any serious rivals, U.S. companies could routinely pass on higher labor and regulatory costs to their customers. Full employment allowed unionized factory workers to move into the middle class, support a family on a single income, and enjoy the stability of health and retirement security. And in such an environment of steady corporate profits and rising wages, policymakers found less political resistance to higher taxes and more regulation to tackle pressing social problems, hence the creation of the Great Society programs, including Medicare, Medicaid, and welfare under Johnson, and the creation of the Environmental Protection Agency and Occupational Health and Safety Agency under Nixon. There was only one problem with this liberal triumph. Capitalism would not stand still. By the 70s, U.S. productivity growth, the engine of the post-war economy, began to lag. The increased assertiveness of OPEC allowed foreign oil producers to lop off a much bigger share of the global economy, exposing America's vulnerability to disruptions in energy supplies. U.S. companies began to experience competition from low-cost producers in Asia. And by the 80s, a flood of cheap imports in textiles, shoes, electronics, and even automobiles had started grabbing big chunks of the domestic market. Meanwhile, U.S.-based multinational corporations began locating some of their production facilities overseas, partly to access these foreign markets, but also to take advantage of cheap labor abroad. In this more competitive global environment, the old corporate formula of steady profits and stodgy management no longer worked. With less ability to pass on higher costs or shoddy products to consumers, corporate profits and market share shrank, and corporate shareholders began demanding more value. Some corporations found ways to improve productivity through innovation and automation. Others relied primarily on brutal layoffs, resistance to unionization, and a further shift of production overseas. Those corporate managers that didn't adapt were vulnerable to corporate raiders and leveraged buyout artists who would make the changes for them without any regard for the employees whose lives might be upended or the communities that might be torn apart. One way or another, American companies became leaner and meaner, with old-line manufacturing workers and the towns like Galesburg bearing much of the brunt of this transformation. It wasn't just the private sector that had to adapt to this new environment. As Ronald Reagan's election made clear, the government did as well. In his rhetoric, Reagan tended to exaggerate the degree to which the welfare state had grown over the previous 25 years. Still, the conservative revolution that Reagan helped usher in gained traction because Reagan's central insight that the liberal welfare state had grown complacent and overly bureaucratic, with Democratic policymakers more obsessed with slicing the economic pie than with growing the pie, contained a good deal of truth. Just as too many corporate managers, shielded from competition, had stopped delivering value, too many government bureaucracies had stopped asking whether their shareholders, the American taxpayer, and their consumers, the users of government services, were getting their money's worth. Forced to compromise with a democratically controlled Congress, Reagan would never achieve many of his most ambitious plans for reducing government, but he fundamentally changed the terms of the political debate. The middle-class tax revolt became a permanent fixture in national politics and placed a ceiling on how much government could expand. For many Republicans, non-interference with the marketplace became an article of faith. Of course, many voters continued to look to government during economic downturns, which helped lift Bill Clinton to the White House. But after the disastrous defeat of his health care plan, Clinton had to trim his ambitions. Declaring the era of big government over, Clinton signed welfare reform, pushed middle-class tax cuts, and worked to reduce bureaucracy and red tape. And it was Clinton who would accomplish what Reagan never did, putting the nation's fiscal house in order, even while lessening poverty and making modest new investments in education and job training. By the time Clinton left office, it appeared as if some equilibrium had been achieved. A smaller government, but one that retained the social safety net FDR had first put into place. Except capitalism is still not standing still. The policies of Reagan and Clinton may have trimmed some of the fat of the liberal welfare state, but they couldn't stop the underlying realities of global competition and technological revolution. Jobs are still moving overseas, not just manufacturing work, but increasingly work in the service sector that can be digitally transmitted, like basic computer programming. Businesses continue to struggle with high healthcare costs. America continues to import far more than it exports, to borrow far more than it lends. Without any clear governing philosophy, the Bush administration and his congressional allies have responded by pushing the conservative revolution to its logical conclusion. Even lower taxes, even fewer regulations, and an even smaller safety net. But in taking this approach, Republicans are fighting the last war, the war they waged and partly won in the 80s, while Democrats are forced to fight a rearguard action defending the New Deal programs of the 30s. neither strategy will work anymore. Americans can't compete with China and India simply by cutting costs and shrinking government, unless we're willing to tolerate a drastic decline in American living standards, with smog-choked cities and beggars lining the streets. Nor can America compete simply by erecting trade barriers and raising the minimum wage, unless we're willing to confiscate all the world's computers. But our history should give us confidence that we don't have to choose between an oppressive, government-run economy and a chaotic, unforgiving capitalism. It tells us that we can emerge from great economic upheavals stronger, not weaker. Like those who came before us, we should be asking ourselves what mix of policies will lead to a dynamic free market and widespread economic security, entrepreneurial innovation, and upward mobility. And we can be guided throughout this process by Lincoln's simple maxim, that we will do collectively, through our government, only those things that we cannot do as well, or at all, individually and privately. In other words, we should be guided by what works. What might such a new economic consensus look like? I won't pretend to have all the answers, and a detailed discussion of U.S. economic policy would fill up several volumes. But I can offer a few examples of where we can break free of our current political stalemate. Places where, in the tradition of Hamilton and Lincoln, we can invest in our infrastructure and our people. Ways that we can begin to modernize and rebuild the social contract that FDR first stitched together in the middle of the last century. Let's start with those investments that can make America more competitive in the global economy. Investments in education, science and technology, and energy independence. Throughout our history, education has been at the heart of a bargain this nation makes with its citizens. If you work hard and take responsibility, you'll have a chance for a better life. The problems with our education system aren't restricted to the inner city. America now has one of the highest high school dropout rates in the industrialized world. By their senior year, American high school students score lower on math and science tests than most of their foreign peers. Unfortunately, instead of innovation and bold reform of our schools, what we've seen from government for close to two decades has been tinkering around the edges and a tolerance for mediocrity. Partly, this is a result of ideological battles that are as outdated as they are predictable. Many conservatives argue that money doesn't matter in raising educational achievement, that the problems in public schools are caused by hapless bureaucracies and intransigent teachers' unions, and that the only solution is to break up the government's education monopoly by handing out vouchers. Meanwhile, those on the left often find themselves defending an indefensible status quo, insisting that more spending alone will improve educational outcomes. Both assumptions are wrong. Money does matter in education. Otherwise, why would parents pay so much to live in well-funded suburban school districts? And many urban and rural schools still suffer from overcrowded classrooms, outdated books, inadequate equipment, and teachers who are forced to pay out of pocket for basic supplies. But there's no denying that the way many public schools are managed poses at least as big of a problem as how well they're funded. Our task, then, is to identify those reforms that have the highest impact on student achievement, fund them adequately, and eliminate those programs that don't produce results. And in fact, we already have hard evidence of reforms that work. A more challenging and rigorous curriculum with emphasis on math, science, and literacy skills. Longer hours and more days to give children the time and sustained attention they need to learn. Early childhood education for every child so they're not already behind on their first day of school. Meaningful performance-based assessments that can provide a fuller picture of how students are doing. And the recruitment and training of transformative principals and more effective teachers. The need for good teachers deserves emphasis. Recent studies show that the single most important factor in determining a student's achievement isn't the color of their skin or where they come from, but who their teacher is. Unfortunately, too many of our schools depend on inexperienced teachers with little training in the subjects they're teaching, and too often those teachers are concentrated in already struggling schools. I constantly meet young people who've graduated from top colleges and have signed up, through programs like Teach for America, for two-year stints in some of the country's toughest public schools, They find the work extraordinarily rewarding. The kids they teach benefit from their creativity and enthusiasm. But by the end of 2 years, most have either changed careers or moved to suburban schools, a consequence of low pay, a lack of support from the educational bureaucracy, and a pervasive feeling of isolation. If we're serious about building a 21st century school system, we're going to have to take the teaching profession seriously. It means paying teachers what they're worth. There's no reason why an experienced, highly qualified, and effective teacher shouldn't earn as much as a lawyer at the peak of his or her career. Highly skilled teachers in such critical fields as math and science, as well as those willing to teach in the toughest urban schools, should be paid even more. There's just one catch. In exchange for more money, teachers need to become more accountable for their performance, and school districts need to have greater ability to get rid of ineffective teachers. Our investment in education can't end with an improved elementary and secondary school system. Most workers are going to need some form of higher education to fill the jobs of the future. Where Americans need help, immediately, is in managing the rising cost of college. Over the last 5 years, the average tuition and fees at four-year public colleges, adjusted for inflation, have risen 40%. To absorb these costs, students have been taking out ever-increasing debt levels, which discourages many undergraduates from pursuing careers in fields like teaching. And an estimated 200,000 college-qualified students each year choose to forego college altogether because they can't figure out how to pay the bills. There are a number of steps we can take to control costs and improve access to higher education. States can limit annual tuition increases at public universities. For many non-traditional students, technical schools and online courses may provide a cost-effective option for retooling in a constantly changing economy. But no matter how well we do in controlling the spiraling cost of education, we will still need to provide many students and parents with more direct help in meeting college expenses, whether through grants, low-interest loans, tax-free educational savings accounts, or full tax deductibility of tuition and fees. So far, Congress has been moving in the opposite direction by raising interest rates on federally guaranteed student loans and failing to increase the size of grants for low-income students to keep pace with inflation. There's one final aspect to our education system that merits attention, one that goes to the heart of America's competitiveness. Since Lincoln signed the Morrill Act and created the system of land-grant colleges, institutions of higher learning have served as the nation's primary R&D laboratories. It's through these institutions that we've trained the innovators of the future, with the federal government providing critical support for the infrastructure, everything from chemistry labs to particle accelerators, and the dollars for research that may not have an immediate commercial application, but that can ultimately lead to major scientific breakthroughs. Here, too, our policies have been moving in the wrong direction. At this year's Northwestern University commencement, I fell into a conversation with Dr. Robert Langer, an institute professor of chemical engineering at MIT and one of the nation's foremost scientists. He explained that 15 years ago, 20 to 30% of all research proposals received significant federal support. That level is now closer to 10%. For scientists and researchers, this means more time spent raising money and less time spent on research. It also means that each year, more and more promising avenues of research are cut off, especially the high-risk research that may ultimately have the biggest reward. Over the last 3 decades, federal funding for the physical, mathematical, and engineering sciences has declined as a percentage of GDP, just at the time when other countries are substantially increasing their own R&D budgets. And as Dr. Langer points out, our declining support for basic research has a direct impact on the number of young people going into math, science, and engineering, which helps explain why China is graduating 8 times as many engineers as the U.S. every year. If we want an innovation economy, one that generates more Googles each year, then we have to invest in our future innovators by doubling federal funding of basic research over the next 5 years. Training 100,000 more engineers and scientists over the next 4 years, or providing new research grants to the most outstanding early career researchers in the country. We can afford to do what needs to be done. What's missing is not money, but a national sense of urgency. The last critical investment we need to make America more competitive is an energy infrastructure that can move us toward the path of energy independence. It's hard to overstate the degree to which our addiction to oil undermines our future. According to the National Commission on Energy Policy, without any changes to our energy policy, U.S. demand for oil will jump 40% over the next 20 years. Over the same period, worldwide demand is expected to jump at least 30%. Our dependence on oil doesn't just affect our economy. It undermines our national security. Every day, we send hundreds of millions of dollars to some of the world's most volatile regimes, Saudi Arabia, Nigeria, Venezuela, and indirectly at least, Iran. It doesn't matter whether they're despotic regimes with nuclear intentions or havens for madrasas that plant the seeds of terror in young minds. They get our money because we need their oil. What's worse, the potential for supply disruption is severe. Osama bin Laden himself advises his followers to, quote, focus your operations on oil, especially in Iraq and the Gulf area, since this will cause them to die off, unquote. And then there are the environmental consequences of our fossil fuel-based economy. Just about every scientist outside the White House believes climate change is real, is serious, and is accelerated by the continued release of carbon dioxide. If the prospect of melting ice caps, rising sea levels, changing weather patterns, more frequent hurricanes, more violent tornadoes, endless dust storms, decaying forests, dying coral reefs, increases in respiratory illness, and insect-borne diseases, if all that doesn't constitute a serious threat, I don't know what does. So far, the Bush administration's energy policy has been focused on subsidies to big oil companies and expanded drilling, coupled with token investments in the development of alternative fuels. What we need to do is create renewable, cleaner energy sources for the 21st century. Instead of subsidizing the oil industry, we should end every single tax break the industry currently receives and demand that 1% of the revenues from oil companies with over $1 billion in profits go towards financing alternative energy research and the necessary infrastructure. Not only would such a project pay huge economic, foreign policy, and environmental dividends, it could be the vehicle by which we train an entire new generation of American scientists and engineers and a source of new export industries and high-wage jobs. Regulation, if applied with flexibility and sensitivity to market forces, can actually spur private sector innovation and investment in the energy sector. Take the issue of fuel efficiency standards. Had we steadily raised fuel efficiency standards over the past two decades, when gas was cheap, U.S. automakers might have invested in new, fuel-efficient models instead of gas-guzzling SUVs, making them more competitive as gas prices rose. Instead, we're seeing Japanese competitors run circles around Detroit. Toyota plans to sell at least 100,000 of their popular Prius this year, while GM's hybrid won't even hit the market until the 2007 model. The bottom line is that fuel-efficient cars and alternative fuels like E85 represent the future of the auto industry, a future American car companies can have if we start making some tough choices now. Aggressively investing in alternative fuel sources could also lead to the creation of thousands of jobs. 10 or 20 years down the road, that old Maytag plant in Galesburg could reopen its doors as a cellulosic ethanol refinery. Down the street, scientists could be busy in a research lab, working on a new hydrogen cell. And across the way, a new auto company could be busy churning out hybrid cars. Education, science and technology, energy. Investments in these three key areas would go a long way in making America more competitive. Of course, none of these investments will yield results overnight. All will be subject to controversy. Still, will that be enough? Assuming we're able to bridge some of our ideological differences and keep the U.S. economy growing, will I be able to look squarely in the eyes of those workers in Galesburg and tell them that globalization can work for them and their children? That was a question on my mind during last year's debate on the Central American Free Trade Agreement, or CAFTA. Viewed in isolation, the agreement posed little threat to American workers. When I met with representatives from organized labor, though, they were having none of it. As far as they were concerned, NAFTA had been a disaster for U.S. workers, and CAFTA just promised more of the same. What was needed, they said, was not just free trade, but fair trade. And yet, stronger labor or environmental provisions in a trade bill wouldn't eliminate the enormous gap in hourly wages between U.S. workers and workers in Honduras, Indonesia, Mozambique, or Bangladesh. Likewise, when all is said and done, China will still have more surplus labor in its countryside than half the entire population of the United States, which means Walmart will be keeping suppliers there busy for a very, very long time. We need a new approach to trade, I would say, one that acknowledges these realities. And my union brothers and sisters would nod and say that they were interested in talking to me about my ideas, but in the meantime, could they mark me as a no vote on CAFTA? As the pace of globalization has picked up, it's not just unions that are worrying about the long-term prospects for U.S. workers. Economists have noted that throughout the world, including in China and India, it seems to take more economic growth each year to produce the same number of jobs, a consequence of ever-increasing automation and higher productivity. Analysts question whether a U.S. economy more dominated by services can expect to see the same productivity growth, and hence rising living standards, as we've seen in the past. In fact, over the past 5 years, statistics consistently show that the wages of American jobs being lost are higher than the wages of American jobs being created. Free trade may well grow the worldwide economic pie, but there's no law that says workers in the United States will continue to get the biggest slice. Given these realities, it's easy to understand why some might want to put a stop to globalization, to freeze the status quo, and insulate ourselves from economic disruption. We can try to slow globalization, but we can't stop it. The U.S. economy is now so integrated with the rest of the world, and digital commerce so widespread, that it's hard to even imagine, much less enforce, an effective regime of protectionism. A tariff on imported steel may give temporary relief to U.S. steel producers, but it will still make every U.S. manufacturer that uses steel in its products less competitive on the world market. It's tough to buy American when a video game sold by a U.S. company has been developed by Japanese software engineers and packaged in Mexico. U.S. Border Patrol agents can't interdict the services of a call center in India or stop an electrical engineer in Prague from sending his work via email to a company in Dubuque. When it comes to trade, there are few borders left. This doesn't mean, however, that we should just throw up our hands and tell workers to fend for themselves. I would make this point to President Bush toward the end of the CAFTA debate, when I and a group of other senators were invited to the White House for discussions. I told the president that resistance to CAFTA had less to do with the specifics of the agreement and more to do with the growing insecurities of the American worker. Unless we found strategies to allay those fears and sent a strong signal to American workers that the federal government was on their side, protectionist sentiment would only grow. The president listened politely and said that he'd be interested in hearing my ideas. In the meantime, he said, he hoped he could count on my vote. He couldn't. I ended up voting against CAFTA, which passed the Senate by a vote of 54 to 45. My vote gave me no satisfaction, but I felt it was the only way to register a protest against what I considered to be the White House's inattention to the losers from free trade. I am optimistic about the long-term prospects for the U.S. economy, but only if we distribute the costs and benefits of globalization more fairly across the population. The last time we faced an economic transformation as disruptive as the one we face today, FDR led the nation to a new social compact, a bargain between government, business, and workers that resulted in widespread prosperity and economic security for more than 50 years. For the average American worker, that security rested on three pillars: the ability to find a job that paid enough to support a family and save for emergencies, a package of health and retirement benefits from his employer, and a government safety net, Social Security, Medicaid, and Medicare, unemployment insurance, and to a lesser extent, federal bankruptcy and pension protections that could cushion the fall of those who suffered setbacks in their lives. This compact rested on an understanding that a system of sharing risks and rewards can actually improve the workings of the market. FDR understood that decent wages and benefits for workers could create the middle-class base of consumers that would stabilize the U.S. economy and drive its expansion. And FDR recognized that we would all be more likely to take risks in our lives, to change jobs or start new businesses or welcome competition from other countries, if we knew that we would have some measure of protection should we fail. That's what Social Security, the centerpiece of New Deal legislation, has provided, a form of social insurance that protects us from risk. Today, the social compact FDR helped construct is beginning to crumble. In response to increased foreign competition and pressure from a stock market that insists on quarterly boosts in profitability, employers are automating, downsizing, and offshoring. The cumulative impact on families is severe. The wages of the average American worker have barely kept pace with inflation over the last two decades. During the same period, the average family's health insurance costs have soared. Personal savings rates have never been lower, and levels of personal debt have never been higher. Rather than use the government to lessen the impact of these trends, the Bush administration's response has been to encourage them. That's the basic idea behind the ownership society. If we free employers of any obligations to their workers and dismantle what's left of New Deal government-run social insurance programs, then the magic of the marketplace will take care of the rest. If the guiding philosophy behind the traditional system of social insurance could be described as, we're all in it together, the philosophy behind the ownership society seems to be, you're on your own. It's a tempting idea, one that's elegant in its simplicity, and that frees us of any obligations we have towards one another. There's only one problem with it. It won't work. At least not for those who are already falling behind in the global economy. The ownership society doesn't even try to spread the risks and rewards of the new economy among all Americans. Instead, it simply magnifies the uneven risks and rewards of today's winner-take-all economy. That's not a recipe for sustained economic growth or the maintenance of a strong American middle class. It's certainly not a recipe for social cohesion. It runs counter to those values that say we have a stake in each other's success. It's not who we are as a people. Fortunately, there's an alternative approach, one that recasts FDR's social compact to meet the needs of a new century. In each area where workers are vulnerable, wages, job loss, retirement, and healthcare, there are good ideas, some old and some new, that would go a long way towards making Americans more secure. Let's start with wages. Americans believe that if somebody works full-time, they should be able to support themselves and their kids. For many people in the bottom rungs of the economy, mainly low-skill workers in the rapidly growing service sector, this basic promise isn't being fulfilled. Government policies can help these workers with little impact on market efficiency. For starters, we can raise the minimum wage. The Earned Income Tax Credit, a program championed by Ronald Reagan that provides low-wage workers with supplemental income through the tax code, should also be expanded and streamlined so more families can take advantage of it. To help all workers adapt to a rapidly changing economy, it's also time to update the existing system of unemployment insurance and trade adjustment assistance. We could extend such assistance to service industries, create flexible education accounts that workers could use to retrain, or provide retraining assistance for workers in sectors of the economy vulnerable to dislocation before they lose their jobs. Any discussion of retirement security should start with a commitment to preserve Social Security's essential character and shore up its solvency. The problems with the Social Security Trust Fund are real but manageable, and there are a number of reasonable options to fix them. With respect to the private retirement system, we should insist that companies fulfill any outstanding promises to their workers and retirees. Bankruptcy laws should be amended to move pension beneficiaries toward the front of the creditor line, so that companies can't just file for Chapter 11 to stiff workers. And if Americans are going to depend on defined contribution plans like 401ks to supplement Social Security, then the government should step in to make them more broadly available to all Americans and more effective in encouraging savings. Which brings us to perhaps our greatest challenge, fixing a broken healthcare system. Unlike Social Security, the two main government-funded healthcare programs, Medicare and Medicaid, really are broken. Without any changes, these two entitlements, along with Social Security, will outpace federal spending on every other priority except defense. The addition of a hugely expensive prescription drug benefit that provides limited coverage and does nothing to control the costs of drugs has only made the problem worse. And the private system has evolved into a patchwork of inefficient bureaucracies, endless paperwork, overburdened providers, and dissatisfied patients. It's time we acknowledged a few simple truths. Given the amount of money we spend on healthcare, more per capita than any other nation, we should be able to provide basic coverage to every single American. With Americans changing jobs more frequently, more likely to go through spells of unemployment, and more likely to work part-time or be self-employed, health insurance can't just run through employers anymore. It needs to be portable. The market alone can't solve our healthcare woes, in part because the market has proven incapable of creating large enough insurance pools to keep costs to individuals affordable, and in part because healthcare is not like other products or services. When your child gets sick, you don't go shopping for the best bargain. And finally, whatever reforms we implement should provide strong incentives for improved quality and more efficient delivery of care. With these principles in mind, let me offer some ideas on what a serious healthcare reform plan might look like. To start, anyone would be allowed to purchase a plan similar to what every member of Congress has through the Federal Employees Health Benefit Plan. But these plans would have to emphasize prevention, primary care, and catastrophic care. By doing so, we could improve quality and cut costs. Insurers would compete for the pool's business. To ensure everyone was covered, we'd provide a subsidy to help families who wanted to purchase health insurance through a state pool and would immediately mandate coverage for all children, similar to what states like Illinois have done for their children, or as Massachusetts requires for everyone. To control costs, we would enroll participants with chronic conditions into a coordinated care management system. Currently, 20% of patients account for 80% of our healthcare costs. Finally, to further drive down costs, we'd require that insurers and providers who are part of Medicaid, Medicare, or new state pools have electronic claims, electronic records, and up-to-date error reporting systems, all of which could substantially reduce costs while improving patient outcomes. The point of this exercise is not to suggest that there's an easy formula for fixing our healthcare system. There isn't. The point is that if we commit ourselves to making sure everybody has decent healthcare, there are ways to accomplish it without breaking the federal treasury or resorting to Canadian-style rationing. That's a bargain with the American people worth making. But there's one last piece to the puzzle, a lingering question that presents itself in every single policy debate in Washington. How do we pay for it? At the end of Bill Clinton's presidency, we had an answer. For the first time in almost 30 years, we enjoyed big budget surpluses and a rapidly declining national debt. Even after the dot-com bubble burst and the economy was forced to absorb the shock of 9/11, we had the opportunity to make a down payment on sustained economic growth and broader opportunity for all Americans. But that's not the path we chose. Instead, we were told by President Bush that we could fight two wars, increase our military budget by 74%, spend more on education, initiate a new prescription drug plan for seniors, and initiate successive rounds of massive tax cuts all at the same time. The result is the most precarious budget situation that we've seen in years. We now have an annual budget deficit of almost $300 billion, not counting billions of dollars each year in emergency Iraq spending that goes directly to our national debt. That debt now stands at almost $9 trillion, approximately $30,000 for every man, woman, and child in the country. It's not the debt alone that's most troubling. Some debt might have been justified if we had spent the money investing in those things that would make us more competitive. We might have used the surplus to shore up Social Security or restructure our healthcare system. Instead, the bulk of the debt is a direct result of the president's tax cuts, 47.4% of which went to the top 5% of the income bracket, 36.7% of which went to the top 1%, and 15% of which went to the top 0.1%, typically people making $1.6 million a year or more. In other words, we ran up the national credit card so that the biggest beneficiaries of the global economy could keep an even bigger share of the take. So far, we've been able to get away with this mountain of debt because foreign central banks, particularly China's, want us to keep buying their exports. But at some point, foreigners will stop lending us money, interest rates will go up, and we will spend most of our nation's output paying them back. If we're serious about avoiding such a future, then we have to start digging ourselves out of this hole. On paper, at least, we know what to do. We can cut and consolidate non-essential programs. We can rein in spending on healthcare costs. We can eliminate tax credits that have outlived their usefulness and close loopholes that let corporations get away with paying no taxes. And we can restore a law that was in place during the Clinton presidency called PAYGO that prohibits money from leaving the federal treasury, either in the form of new spending or tax cuts, without some way of compensating for the lost revenue. If we take all of these steps, emerging from this fiscal situation will still be difficult. We'll probably have to postpone some investments that we know are needed to improve our competitive position in the world, and we will have to prioritize the help that we give to struggling American families. But even as we make these difficult choices, we should ponder the lesson of the past 6 years and ask ourselves whether our budgets and our tax policy really reflects the values that we profess to hold. We will have to stop pretending that all cuts in spending are equivalent, or that all tax increases are the same. Ending corporate subsidies that serve no discernible economic purpose is one thing. Reducing healthcare benefits to poor children is something else entirely. At a time when ordinary families are feeling hit from all sides, the impulse to keep their taxes as low as possible is honorable and right. What's less honorable has been the willingness of the rich and the powerful to ride this anti-tax sentiment for their own purposes, or the way the president, Congress, lobbyists, and conservative commentators have been able to successfully conflate in the mind of voters the very real tax burdens of the middle class and the very manageable tax burdens of the wealthy. So let's be clear. The rich in America have little to complain about. Between 1971 and 2001, while the median wage and salary income of the average worker showed literally no gain, the income of the top 0.01% went up almost 500%. The distribution of wealth is even more skewed, and levels of inequality are now higher than any time since the Gilded Age. These trends were already at work throughout the 90s. Clinton's tax policies simply slowed them down a bit. Bush's tax cuts make them worse. I point out these facts not, as Republican talking points would have it, to stir up class envy. I admire many Americans of great wealth and don't begrudge their success in the least. I know that many, if not most, have earned it through hard work, building businesses and creating jobs and providing value to their customers. I simply believe that those of us who have benefited most from this new economy can best afford to shoulder the obligation of ensuring every American child has a chance for that same success. More than anything else, it is that sense, that despite great differences in wealth, we are all bound together, which we can't afford to lose.